Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the Trump presidency releases its budget plans for 2018 today, reports are already circulating on the expected increase amounts for border security and the building of more barriers on the southern border. Over 700 miles of barriers have been built since 2006 at a cost of $3.4 billion. According to the General Accounting Office, the 25-year cost of construction and maintenance for that barrier is expected to exceed $49 billion. My guest today looks at the state of this barrier, resembling a wall in some places, more like a fence in others, and how this wall, rather than keep people away and out, has been an attractor, as commerce, social events, even art, are already occurring where the barrier has been constructed. And as for its purpose, for every barrier innovation, there seems to have been equally innovative counter-strategies to breach it. Architect Ronald Rael's book, Border Wall as Architecture, offers a reimagining of this wall. His fanciful ideas are not intended as a literal way to build a barrier, but as a way to refocus the conversation to the culture around the border and how the communities and peoples of the borderlands interact, even with a barrier in their midst. Ronald Rael is an associate professor in the Department of Architecture and Art Practice at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Border Wall as Architecture, a manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico boundary. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Ronald Rael, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich.
How did you get interested in imagining a border wall along the U.S.-Mexican border? What was the reason for writing this book?
Wasn't so much to imagine border walls, it was to call to attention the 650 miles of wall that already exists. So the propositions within the book aren't designed for new border walls, they're designs that go alongside the existing border wall to fix the problems that it has created.
And what are the problems that you see as the existing fence or walls have already created?
There are many different kinds of walls in many different kinds of places, and so there are many different kinds of problems. Some of the problems have to do with the lives of human beings who attempt to migrate to the United States, and the wall pushes them to further extremes in the desert, causing dehydration and death. Animals can't travel on their migratory routes naturally in search of food and water, and so that transforms their lives, and even scientists are beginning to discover that it's affecting their genetic makeup, because you can't have the same kind of diversity that you once had because they're not able to travel to their natural habitats back and forth. Birds are affected, and very many endangered species are affected, and cities are affected because, for many reasons, one, it divides many cities along the border, but also even something as simple as a rainstorm was not anticipated in many cases in the design of the existing border wall. And in some cases, the rain built up against the wall, it became a dam, and it knocked it over. And in other cases, the rain rushed off into a city and flooded the city because it ran alongside the border wall. So there's a number of problems. And so, really, the book calls into attention these problems. And in many cases, celebrates and recognizes the way that people have come together along the border to challenge the wall, but also to celebrate their binational identities.
You know, when we think of international friendship parks, we think of along the U.S.-Canadian border, like Campobello or Waterton Lakes and Glacier in Montana. There's a friendship park in Tijuana, I believe, and for many years it existed, maintained by both countries, and of course now there is a wall right through the middle of it now.
Right. Well, there was always, even in its inauguration, Friendship Park did have a very small barbed wire fence with a couple of strands of barbed wire. And when it was inaugurated by Pat Nixon, the First Lady said that she would like to have that barbed wire cut so that she could focus on the celebration and reach across and hug people and shake hands with people. And she said, well, I hope this fence isn't up for very long, thinking that why is this in there in the first place? And now it's highly fortified and even has double and triple layers of wall in place.
Wow. Now, one of the things you put the cost of what's already been constructed and what sort of costs we're looking at if the current administration goes ahead with its plan to create a wall along more sections of the border. What has been the cost of this wall so far? You mentioned the flooding. That was in Nogales, Arizona, and created amazing problems along that border, just drainage.
That's absolutely right. And to construct and maintain the existing wall that's already in place, it's estimated to cost up to, I believe it's $49 billion over the next 25 years. And so I would like to ask the question, what else might we buy for $49 billion along the border? So I think that borderland investment is extremely important because it is one of the fastest growing and poorest regions of the country, as well as Mexico.
Now, I think it might surprise a lot of people that when you look at our border fence or border wall today, we think of it as maybe a couple of types. There's actually 11 different types of border barriers. Can you tell us a little bit about all the different types that are already existing?
Sure. There are walls that are intended to serve different purposes. Some of the walls are intended to stop vehicles. Some of the walls are used as levees because they're built close to the river or alongside the river. And some are for to stop pedestrians. And in each case, they have different sizes, different materials. Some are made out of concrete. Some are made out of steel. Some are made out of recycled materials like railroad tracks or the leftovers of landing mats from the Vietnam War, where helicopters would land on in the wet marsh and rice paddies. So these are the kinds of walls that exist, and these are their purposes, and they change from place to place. In some cases, you know, I often call them walls. In some places, there are just simply fences, barbed wire fences that people have put up. And in many cases, there's nothing there. And there may be rivers or stretches of rivers or stretches of land that are very difficult to build a wall or a fence in.
Yeah, and some are virtual, which they're using drones and motion detection and radar and the like, and they don't even bother putting up a fence. I think that's in some of the remote areas.
That's right. There's something called a virtual wall that was put in place as a government contract, and it had a lot of high-tech equipment and extremely expensive, but it really failed to serve its purpose. The sensors couldn't differentiate between a person and animal. So there was a lot of difficulties with that virtual wall, but there's a tremendous amount of surveillance along the U.S.-Mexico border, and thus a sort of invisible wall, if you will.
Yeah. Now, you've alluded to the purpose of the wall. What may be interesting to, even as the wall is being proposed today, it's not to completely stop traffic, is it?
Well, I think that it's recognized that it won't stop traffic.
Right.
But the Department of Homeland Security and Border Patrol recognize that it serves as a five-minute delay, and that a five-minute delay in someone crossing in an undocumented way is much more likely to be apprehended with that kind of delay. So it's a five-minute speed bump.
Yeah, in fact, you reproduce the border calculus. There's actually a border calculus by the Border Patrol.
Right, this is a mathematical formula that's used depending on the wall's adjacency to a city or an open landscape or other buildings that suggest that if it's this type of wall in this type of scenario, that one is more likely to be apprehended. And so this is one way that the Department of Homeland Security implements walls in the landscape based on this border calculus.
Now, you also include some of the amazing amount of money that's gone into testing. You have a wonderful photograph of a remote-controlled vehicle ramming into a wall prototype at about 40 miles an hour. How much money is being spent on actually figuring out how to build a wall?
Well, there are millions of dollars being spent on designing the wall and constructing the wall, obviously. And there's sort of a wall arms race in place, because if you think about the millions of dollars that are used to design the walls at Sandia National Laboratory or Texas A&M or at private contractor companies that are being paid to do this, the Army Corps of Engineers as well. But then on the other side of the border, there's research going on as well. So despite fence labs, designs that demonstrate you can ram a truck loaded up with several tons of material at 40 miles an hour into the wall, and it doesn't knock the wall down, we've seen how there have been deployable mobile ramps placed on walls that are up to 16 feet tall where the vehicles just drive over the wall. So if we think about that famous quote, show me a 20-foot wall and I'll show you a 21-foot ladder. I think that applies here.
Yeah. In fact, you reproduce a photograph from, I'm not sure exactly, the Yuma section of the wall, where they found a Jeep Cherokee high centered on the middle of the wall with a ramp designed for it to drive down. And apparently it just was a little too big, and you literally have a Jeep Cherokee impaled on the top of the wall.
Right, and that's an actual Border Patrol photo of this Jeep hung up on the middle of the wall, teeter-tottering above. But that wall, in particular, isn't meant to stop vehicles. That's meant to stop pedestrians, so it's built quite high. Vehicle barriers are only a few feet high, like 3 or 4 feet high, so those are very easy to drive over by vehicles with just some mobile ramps. Sometimes the ramps are actually attached to trucks, and they unfold, so a truck can drive right up to a wall, unfold its deployable bridges, and another vehicle can drive right over that sort of moving bridge.
So it's going to be very difficult to build a barrier that really is impermeable, and at the same time, there'll be a tremendous environmental and probably human costs involved with it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very difficult to imagine a wall that would actually stop anyone from coming, but also allow the types of, well, to allow nature to run its course. And I think immigration is part of nature. But fundamentally, the issue is a wall the right solution? And I certainly don't believe so. I think we've seen how the 650 miles of wall that is already in place has come at a great cost to taxpayer money, but also in human lives.
And that is also something that's not really well publicized. What has been the death toll around these sections of walls? Is it over 5,000 people?
Yes, and that number goes up every day. I think since 1994, over 6,000 people have died attempting to cross the border. And this is often due to dehydration. It's incredibly hot, and people walk many miles through the desert trying to reach the United States and improve their lives. So again, could we think about that amount of money, let's say $49 billion over the next 25 years, reinvested into libraries and clean water and photovoltaic energy and all the kinds of social infrastructures that make places safe and secure? Those are the kind of questions this book is asking.
My guest today is Ronald Rael, associate professor in the Department of Architecture as well as Art Practice at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. There's something you said earlier, which was also sort of a central point of the book, which is we think of walls as barriers, but they're also attractors. Every wall that has been built has been an attractor, whether it was the Berlin Wall or the barrier between East and West through Germany, the Great Wall of China. Virtually every wall is an attractor in a way. What do you mean by that, really?
Well, the reason the book is entitled Border Wall as Architecture is because architecture defines spaces and creates spaces. And typically you think that architects design walls, but in fact they design the spaces between them. And so a wall has been constructed, and it has served as a catalyst for different kinds of spaces to emerge along the border. And this has brought people together in really remarkable ways, often to rebel against the wall, of course, but also it's begun a way to, as I mentioned before, celebrate the binational identities that exist along the border. There is not necessarily a here or there, United States or Mexico. There are families who've crossed the border for centuries. Of course, animals, culture, food, language, this is all part of a gradient that spans the border, and so it has catalyzed people to come together. And I mention in the book, and I demonstrate these through drawings, that there are binational yoga classes that take place along the border. There are horse races, as you mentioned. There are these binational events. In fact, just day before yesterday, between Agua Prieta and Douglas, Arizona, there was a binational performance that the book sort of foretold would occur. In the book, I show a binational theater where people sit alongside the border wall, and there are performances on a stage that spans across the border wall as well, perpendicular to it. And so just yesterday, this actually occurred, or day before yesterday, this actually occurred between these two cities. There was a binational theater performance with musicians and projection. And so the wall can continues to serve as a form of architecture that's bringing people together.
There's also a picture in Naco, Sonora and Naco, Arizona, where years ago, perhaps when the border wall was not quite so large, this is 2007, they had a volleyball match.
Yes, and volleyball has been played along the border since the late 70s. There was a volleyball match, and it's quite interesting because that wall sort of ends right after the city of Naco. And so there's a wall that exists, and then it just stops. And so this event, this fiesta, this binational fiesta took place. And at the end of the wall, where the wall stops, there's a Tecate beer stand that actually straddles both sides of the wall, selling beer on both sides. But the volleyball game takes place with people on both sides. And that, again, speaks to what I think is the irony or the ridiculousness of the wall. It's a very strange conundrum of how things pass or who passes and why, the amount of investment that takes place, the beauty of those acts that take place in cities and fiestas, and also the horror and violence that the wall creates.
In fact, many places the wall or the fence is the meeting place for reunions.
Yes, and especially in Friendship Park, where it's no longer allowed on a casual basis any longer, but there were events, and one could go to the beach there in Tijuana and on the San Diego side and sit, and families would have a picnic and pass food through the wall. And in one case, there was a photograph documenting a Border Patrol agent buying a frozen dessert through the wall. So money was exchanged, food was exchanged, and so something as normal as simply buying an ice cream from a food vendor becomes wrought with questions about illegal trade. And this is why, in some cases, my drawings aren't necessarily proposals for walls, but they remember these events. So I have a drawing and a model called the Burrito Wall, where there are food carts and seats and tables built onto the wall so that people could have exchanges of food and conversations across the border.
So if they're not real proposals, you say they're remembrances of events that occurred along the wall, but some of them seem like they could be actual proposals.
Well, I think they're proposals in the same way the wall itself is a proposal. The wall is a proposal to stop people, but does it actually serve its intended purpose? And so mine operates in the same way, you might say, in that, well, people are coming together along the border, and I think that is something that we should continue to promote. I think there are reasons why we should consider the wildlife and the natural resources and some of our wilderness areas that are damaged and divided by the borderlands. So those are real proposals, but they are also about a conversation that I think needs to take place about the wall and its existence. And it's my hope that art and design are valid forms of protest, and that's what this book attempts to do. It calls to attention these landscapes and the stories of the people who live in these landscapes, and hopefully through the act of information and demonstrating these through illustrations and models, that one, we remember what we've done so we can think about what not to do as we continue to think about the construction of walls along the border in the future.
Now, you mentioned the environmental damage to sensitive areas. There's one, well, there's several national monuments right along the Mexican-U.S. border. One particular that gets quite a bit of publicity is Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument.
Right.
And this is a pretty remote area of Arizona. There's like one transnational road that passes through the national monument. There's a number of small off-road sort of four-wheel drive roads and dirt roads within the park. But since the Secure Fence Act, which is the first iteration of this wall between the United States and Mexico, which came about in the early 2000s, you've seen this wall push far more people to this national monument. And there's an amazing reproduction of a map from the National Park Service showing how the whole park been impacted by numerous trails, Border Patrol driving off-road to apprehend illegal people, and it's had this just major impact on the national monument. So what was your takeaway from this?
Well, this condition is one of these moments where my drawing is questioned and criticized and asked if this is a proposal or not a proposal, and it becomes confusing because I did a drawing called The Cactus Wall.
Right.
In response to this. And so we have seen how once the wall was constructed, it pushed many more people into that wilderness where technically and legally motorized vehicles are not allowed in any shape or form. Because of the Secure Fence Act of 2006, vehicle Border Patrol agents are allowed to go off-road if they perceive that someone is crossing illegally. And so in chasing people down, because the wall has pushed people there, the wilderness is now wrought with trails. And this very sensitive landscape that is part of our national heritage, where we're attempting to preserve these amazing species of plants, has now been destroyed. And so my drawing, as a proposition, calls to attention that perhaps we should dismantle the wall because that's what's causing the problems, and aggressively replant cactus back in the areas that were damaged. And that would be a much more valuable investment in our national heritage sites. So, again, I'm often criticized to say, oh, you want to create these cactus walls because those are more dangerous. And, you know, the London Review of Books mentioned how, oh, it would tear people apart. And so that's not the intention. The intention is to call into question how we engage these landscapes. And is planting and restoring this landscape more important than its destruction for the sake of a wall that is actually promoting people to cross to the other side in this case?
One of the interesting things is you really re-envision the border as a place where both sides could benefit. A greenhouse wall, a solar farm wall, along the coastline of Tijuana, maybe a border fence that recaptures fog, the water from fog that comes inland during certain times of the year, something that used for wastewater treatment as a function of the wall. Maybe explain a little bit what you mean by those sorts of projects.
Okay, sure. Well, there are many cases along the border where the infrastructure is shared across the border from the United States and Mexico. There are cases where electrical grids exist that transcend the border, or city water grids extend along the border. And so these projects, these types of drawings and proposals, ask a different kind of question, which is, there is a material infrastructure that already exists. And while this book is in opposition to the wall, is there a way to transform the wall and its physical characteristics as an infrastructural armature to build upon and to create these other types of productive infrastructures? So could we use it as a hot water generator for clinics and schools and homes? Could we build upon it a series of life safety beacons to protect both United States citizens and Mexican citizens who are traveling in the desert and are in trouble? Could we build upon it pedestrian paths, both in the United States and Mexico? Because it's a tremendous amount of material, and it took a tremendous amount of resources. And so I'm just simply asking the question, can we find utility in it that extends beyond its current utility, which is not proving to be so useful, in fact?
My guest today is Ronald Rael, an associate professor of architecture and art practice at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. Well, one of the things you also outline is, just like once the Berlin Wall went up, it became all of a sudden a magnet for artists. The existing fence or border has already become a magnet for artists. I'm thinking of somebody like Teresa Fernandez, or the musician performance artist that created a xylophone work of using the wall as a performance piece. If you can, talk a little bit about some of these efforts.
Sure. The work by the Mexican artist Ana Teresa Fernandez, who lives in San Francisco, is really interesting to me because what she has done is a project called Erasing the Border. And she does this by painting the wall on the Mexican side a blue color that is very similar to the color of the sky. And this creates a remarkable effect. It appears as if the wall has simply been erased and there's an opening in the wall. And it's not only beautiful, but I think it's very evocative about how art can be a form of resistance. But what's most fascinating to me about that work, which is part of the irony of the wall, is that the communities on the Mexican side of the border really love that installation. They love that work of art, and they have done everything to protect it. So they don't allow people to graffiti on it or damage it in any way, because the wall is constantly being attacked and attempted to be dismantled. So there are people who take care of that particular artwork. Now, I always wonder if there's ever a president who says, okay, we must tear down this wall, perhaps the residents of Tijuana might preserve this section of the wall because it's such a beautiful work of art. So therein lies the ironies that they would actually preserve a section of the wall that has been dematerialized or has become invisible by art. And that, again, is what's interesting about the wall to study, to think about the ways people react against it and how it shapes the spaces around it.
And I was mentioning the musician Glenn Wyatt. He actually enlisted a Border Patrol agent to create a musical piece with a portion of the wall that, I guess, it had a resonant section where he could use it. And that was the basis for your proposal of a xylophone wall.
Yes, again, the xylophone wall grows from Glenn's work. It calls into question or even maybe institutionalizes the proposition of how ridiculous would it be to build the world's largest xylophone and allow for binational performances. And I think what Glenn does is just that. He doesn't see the wall as an infrastructure of security. He sees it as an instrument. And the moment he begins to perceive it in a different way, it transforms its meaning and therefore, in a sense, begins to neuter the wall and its purpose. And so, again, this is why musicians and artists and designers can be very powerful agents in activism. And so Glenn's work, certainly when he plays it like a cello, or he bangs on it, or he invites people to have binational performances, or he invites Border Patrol agents, he's immediately transforming that structure into an instrument. And in many ways, I think, taking away its power. The borderlands have always been historical places of exchange, and they're fluid. And so to construct a wall is an act against nature. It's an act against the natural forms of exchange that take place along the borderlands. These are rich and diverse landscapes. I think often, if we think about President Trump's campaign, and he ran on a campaign that in part suggested that he would build a border wall, and audiences clapped and cheered, but it sort of demonstrated the ignorance that exists about the fact that one-third of the borderlands are already walled off. And there are lessons to be learned. And so I'm hoping this book calls into attention and is a useful tool as a field guide to understanding the wall and the places that it cuts through in what I call these divided states, because they are the United States of America and the United Mexican States that have been divided by this structure.
Professor Rael, we appreciate your time. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much as well.
Ronald Rael is an associate professor in the Departments of Architecture and Art Practice at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Border Wall as Architecture, Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. It's published by the University of California Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.